This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
Support for the Exchange Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Brady Carlson, and this is The Exchange. It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. It was crossover day in the New Hampshire legislature when all of this session's House bills need to be sent to the Senate and vice versa. Among the many bills lawmakers were exchanging was a plan to continue the state's expanded Medicaid program. Steve Onan, head of the New Hampshire Hospital Association, made his case for the bill before lawmakers.
Hundreds of millions of dollars of resources that are coming into the state of New Hampshire to help support those who provide care for patients is absolutely reducing the cost that has to be borne by those who provide it as well as those who pay for it.
A bill to regulate the use of drones in New Hampshire cleared a hurdle in the House and now heads to the Senate. Republican John Burt of Goffstown argued the bill could cast too large a net.
And this could be your grandson or your granddaughter that is using a drone innocently. Even though they say it has to be an intent to break the law, who is the judge of that?
And Governor Maggie Hassan named Assistant Attorney General James Vera to be the state's new drug czar. Vera helped write the law that brought penalties for fentanyl on par with heroin. Late last year, he told lawmakers that change was necessary to fight drug dealers.
You have a strong population of people who are using and dealing for their own use, and then you have a certain subset of people who are selling directly for profit. And the penalty should be appropriate if someone is selling large, significant amounts of this drug.
It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange, and let's hear from you. Call in with your questions and comments. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. Email us, exchange@nhpr.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests for the hour are Trent Spinner, executive editor for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. Good morning.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And Dan Barrick, NHPR's senior policy and politics editor. Hi there.
Hey, Brady.
A busy week for lawmakers, to say the least, the crossover. Dan, just a little context here. Could you explain how far along crossover day comes in a legislative session?
Well, I think if you just go just purely chronologically, it's really the midpoint. But it's the point, and it's written into the House and Senate rules, where any bill that's in the House has got to get over to the Senate. The House has got to complete its action and vice versa. It's a way of moving things along. And it's sort of like, you know, it's like the center of the hourglass, so to speak. Everything's got to sift through. And, you know, the second year of the session is typically a less frenzied time. You know, the first year is when lawmakers take care of the budget, which is usually the biggest piece of legislation of the year. And you get an interesting blend of, you know, some really serious pieces of legislation like the Medicaid expansion, reauthorization, a series of bills that's aimed at dealing with the state's opioid crisis, and some more offbeat ones, you know, drone regulation, sex ed. So it's a frantic time, to say the least, and keeping track of it either from a news point of view or a policy point of view or just a sheer entertainment point of view is pretty hairy. And this week was no different.
And as you mentioned, there was a sort of a rush over the last few weeks where the lawmakers were trying to get ready for crossover day so that they could send along what was going to be sent along. But also, as you mentioned, as Dan mentioned, Trent, there were some big bills in this year's legislative calendar, and one of them being the proposal to continue Medicaid expansion, moving now from the House to the Senate. The Senate held a public hearing this week. How was that, if at all, different from what we've been hearing over the last few months in the House?
Right. And just to add to Dan's point about crossover week and how difficult it is, just consider the logistics of what's happening here, right? All of the House bills are going in the Senate. All the Senate bills are going in the House. And so that makes for some incredibly long days. I think both of these chambers took up dozens and dozens of bills. So you're talking about everyone being there. everyone having an opportunity to talk. And then, you know, you have to vote on these bills. So it makes for some long, difficult days, not just to cover for us, but, you know, for the people who actually have to do it. As far as Medicaid expansion, I mean, this is, you know, I think this is, I think what we're going to see, I think it's going to be a big question to see what happens here. You know, the Senate leadership really worked on this bill. You know, there was some pretty feisty debate in the House about what happens. But the governor's office wants this. And so I think we have to see what happens.
Dan, what do you make of what you've been hearing so far about the Medicaid expansion?
Well, I think it's got a fairly good shot of going through. It would reauthorize the program as it now exists, which expands Medicaid coverage to, you know, so-called able-bodied adults without kids. It includes a few other things that are not part of the program as it now exists. One, slightly different funding mechanism because the federal government will be decreasing its share of how much of the program it covers. States, hospitals, insurance companies have agreed to put some money on the table and help cover that because of the benefits that they see. There's also a work requirement, which would require that folks either be employed or looking for work if they're going to be covered. But it also includes what they call the severability clause, which means because Medicaid is a joint state federal program, the parameters of any program a state writes up has to be approved by the federal government. The federal government's never approved a Medicaid program with a work requirement. So in the possibility that the federal government rejects that could be severed from New Hampshire's plan, and then the rest of the expansion could go forward. That was a key piece in order for it to get through the Senate committee. And just in terms of the politics of it, we've seen throughout this year, and I think it's been mollified a little bit, but a real divide within the Republican caucus and the legislature over this. You have leadership, as Trent said, leadership has been behind this. Senator Jeb Bradley and House Speaker Jasper have both endorsed it, and a lot of more conservative members of the Republican caucus are really against it for ideological or policy or financial reasons. I don't think it's going to be enough to tip the vote against it, but it has been a brewing political subtext here.
We are hearing some of the opposition, I know, from groups like Americans for Prosperity in New Hampshire, Trent, who were saying this bill as written, essentially it has a work requirement that doesn't really require work because of that severability clause Dan mentioned. But then we also had state senators like Andy Sanborn, who basically asked everyone who testified at the Tuesday's hearing to guarantee that costs and premiums wouldn't increase. So saying, how do we know how effective this really is? Can anybody guarantee that this is going to be effective going forward?
No, and I think what's interesting about the work requirement, people are spending so much time talking about this. The federal government has made absolutely no indication that they are going to allow this. I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think that the federal government will give New Hampshire a waiver to let this happen. But then, as Dan pointed out, I mean, there's really a split in the Republican caucus about how this is supposed to work. There are some groups like AFP, like you mentioned, who they're against this, right? They don't think that this is the role of government. And then you have other groups who say, look, this is federal money, and if we don't take it, it's hundreds of millions of dollars that we're sort of leaving on the table. And then in response, you know, the more conservative members say, that's still our money, right? Even though it's coming from the federal government, we're still paying for that as taxpayers, and we shouldn't have to. I think it's been a real battle. I think what's going to happen is that a Medicaid expansion will go through. I think that the more centrist Republicans will be able to – they have the votes to make this happen. They have the political consensus to make it happen.
So, Dan, then at that point then, given what Trent's saying about the federal government maybe not being receptive to that idea of a waiver for the work requirement, is that just simply a mechanism, something that Republicans can point to in the bill and say, well, we put a work requirement in and therefore we're okay with trying to pass it, and maybe not much beyond that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what that's the way it's been described, that the benefit of the program, the benefit of, you know, insuring some 45,000 additional residents of New Hampshire is really the ultimate goal. That's sort of the argument that's being made, and that the work requirement is good policy and a good goal, but it shouldn't, you know, sort of be the stumbling block that would lead to the failure to authorize the entire program. And you know, the other thing too is you're seeing, you know, the argument against this has evolved considerably from one that was, I think you could fairly say, was purely ideological, sort of saying this is part of Obamacare. Obamacare is a mess. It's an example of government overreach into government overreach, to one where, as Trent alluded to in the hearing in the Senate, you had some senators like Andy Samborn really questioning the financial of the program, actually saying there's no – whether or not the ideologically or philosophically you believe that government should be in the role of providing health care to able-bodied adults, what is the real benefit? And really questioning hospital executives and others and sort of saying as I heard it, almost sort of saying, I don't really trust the numbers you're saying about what the benefit is.
That because the hospitals were very clear. They said the amount of money we have to put toward what's called uncompensated care has gone dramatically down. And he's saying, I'm not sure I believe that.
That when you actually sort of – and it's hard to know because the hospital's most recent financial statements aren't available yet. It's really hard to make that comparison. But the hospitals are saying there's fewer uninsured people coming in our doors who we have to care for free. And that's really those basic financials are really being challenged.
I mean, what the hospitals are saying, they're saying, in the state, we spend about $400 million on unfunded, on charity care, essentially. People come into our, come into our hospital. They don't have insurance. And we still care for them. And so they spend about $400 million on that. And what they're saying is if you expand Medicaid to cover people who are close to the poverty level, that amount of money that they have to spend will go down significantly. The federal government will kick in a whole bunch of the cost, about 90, 95% of the cost. And then they're willing, between the hospitals and the insurance companies, they're willing to kick in the rest so that taxpayers don't have to. And the way this plan is set up is that if they don't kick in that money, it goes away. So I think and that's what the Republican leadership really worked on putting together, bringing the hospitals, the insurance companies, legislators to the table to make this happen. So I think they have the support that they're going to need.
And the Senate Finance Committee is set to take that bill up next week. We'll continue to follow the latest as it moves through the legislature. This is The Exchange on NHPR. Today on The Exchange, it's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. We're taking a look at some of the top New Hampshire news stories of the week, and we hope you'll join us with your comments and questions at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477, or email us exchange@nhpr.org. Trent, another big debate at the State House this week was on a bill that would legalize needle exchange programs. Could you give us a few details?
Sure. We're the only state in New England that doesn't allow people who have a dirty needle, so a needle that they've used to inject themselves with illegal drugs. In other states, what you're allowed to do, if you're a user, you're allowed to trade in your needle to get a clean needle. And what people say is that helps keep HIV and hepatitis C infections down among the user population. Police are against this. They think it takes away a very important tool for them. It becomes very difficult for them to arrest somebody who has drug paraphernalia on them.
Because that's physical evidence.
Right. And so right now, if you have a needle that you used and it has just a microscopic amount of, let's say, heroin in it, you can be arrested and charged. And that becomes more difficult under this bill. So there is a big debate, even though other states have already done this and they've seen a decrease in Hep C and HIV infections. Police say that they really want to they don't want this.
Let's hear from a member of the State House. This is Republican John Thal of Whitefield. Here's what he had to say about the needle exchange proposal.
I would prefer to see us do something that creates a needle exchange program or at least allows the state to set guidelines for a needle exchange program rather than what it is now, which all it does is give a free pass to everybody that wants to have a dirty needle.
Again, that's State Representative John Thal of Whitefield. Dan, a lot of discussion here amongst this bill, even despite the fact that it wound up passing fairly easily in the House.
It did, and it came the unusual step. It came out of committee without a vote to recommend it to vote, and ended up passing. But I think aside from the merits of this as policy, it's an interesting issue because I think it really encapsulates, perhaps more than anything else, the real tension at the heart of how New Hampshire and other states try and address the drug epidemic, which is either a more treatment-based seeing addiction as a medical condition, as something that needs to be addressed through medicine and other treatments versus a more law enforcement approach. And you could see that here. Trent laid it out that police are against this because they feel it takes ties their hands and their ability to arrest addicts or at least dealers versus, you know, in a needle exchange, there's public health benefits to that. And then also, you know, when people engage in these exchanges, there's an opportunity for treatment folks to engage with them and to, you know, try and deal with their addiction. So it really encapsulates this tension that I'm not sure New Hampshire has really quite figured out which road, which approach will dominate. You know, treating it as a law enforcement problem or a medical problem, a public health problem.
And that tension, Trent, is something that at least public officials have talked about in terms of, well, we can't arrest our way out of the problem, but there's a role for law enforcement too. But in practice, it can often be much more difficult than that kind of rhetoric might suggest.
That's exactly right. I mean, think about the police officer on the street in Manchester who has to make these decisions. And you know what's interesting? I always love to read the comments on the stories, especially state house stories that are controversial. And what I saw in a couple of the comments, actually not even just at the Union Leader, but across a couple of different outlets, was people saying, you know, we should create facilities. We should create areas, safe areas where people can – where addicts can go to do heroin. And I just thought that was an interesting – I mean, that's really taking this needle exchange all the way to the end of the spectrum. But they said, look, like we're having a problem arresting our way out of this. We're having a problem getting people treated. Why don't we create places where they can go? And if they're going to do heroin, they can do it there. Narcan will be available, and you know, and we can provide treatment right on the spot. So I just think it's an interesting. I'm not endorsing that in any way. I just think it's an interesting part of the debate.
That is something that I've heard being done in some other countries. But when I first heard about the needle exchange bill and the idea that this would prevent Hep C and things like that from spreading, it my mind jumped right to that case in Indiana where you did see a spike among users in hepatitis C and other diseases. And that state then wound up having to sort of re-up its needle exchange program to try to bring those numbers back down.
That's right. And we haven't seen real numbers yet about how big of a problem this is in New Hampshire. You know, we're still waiting. You know, we're still pretty relatively early on in this epidemic. You know, it's been going on for, I'd say, 2 years or so now. Seriously, we've been seriously covering it for 2 years now. So we haven't seen any statistics yet that really showed how necessary this program is.
Dan, a lot of the bills like this one I've mentioned have passed with pretty substantial margins in the chambers of the State House. But there has been some disagreement lately between Republicans and Democrats over how much additional funding to put forward for treatment and prevention programs. At one point, the governor had called for, I think, $5 million, and some members of the legislature cut that number in half. And it's hard to know, at least as a layman, exactly where each of those dollars is going to go and how much is the right number.
No, you're right. I mean, and this has been since, I guess, the end of last year when it became clear that much of this legislative session would be dedicated to trying to come up with some solutions. That basic budgeting question between the governor, who put forth a proposal, I think she said $80 million was her – I could be wrong, but I believe $80 million stands out, and the Republicans in the legislature urging a more slower, measured – let's kind of see how the financials come in. The state is sitting on a surplus, I believe, of roughly $60 million or so. Democrats have said that much of that money should go towards funding better treatment options – recovery spending, but Republicans continue to sort of say, well, you know, we're willing to spend some, but we can't spend the entire surplus on that. But I do think, in general, I've been surprised by how the lack of real discord between the parties over this, especially considering you've got Governor Hassan, who's running for Senate, and Republicans, you know, sort of, if you just pure politics, would have every incentive to trip her up there. But both on Medicaid expansion and on many of the opioid bills, there's been disagreements across party lines, but everybody's moving in the same direction.
The dynamics.
Which is not always the case.
The dynamics in that case then make it very difficult to sort of have each side laying into each other, I would imagine. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. This is our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. We're taking a look at some of the top stories from the State House and across the state, and we hope you'll join us with your comments and questions. The Exchange phone number, if you'd like to weigh in, is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. More comments about this week's business at the State House after a short break. This is NHPR. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Brady Carlson. As always, you can join us with your comments and questions about the week's news. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And we're also on Facebook and Twitter. Our guests for the hour are Trent Spinner, executive editor for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News, and NHPR senior politics and policy editor Dan Barrick. We hope you'll join us again with your comments and questions. Before we move on, just a couple more items from the State House this week. Trent, the Senate passed a bill late yesterday that would broaden an individual's ability to get a state license to carry a concealed gun. How is this different from the current concealed carry laws?
If any of your listeners have ever attempted or have gotten one of these permits, a concealed carry license, what they would see on the application is the word suitable, right? So if they go to the police department or their selectman and they would like a concealed carry license, someone has to do the work of figuring out if they are suitable to get it. And that has caused some issues, especially in some smaller towns where, you know, the police are very familiar with someone, let's say, and maybe don't want to give them that license. So what this bill would do is it would remove that word, and it would allow police – it would allow anyone who's legally able to have a firearm to also have a concealed carry license.
So essentially it takes that discretion out of the hands of the police and say if you're allowed legally to hold that firearm or weapon that you are authorized to get that permit.
That's right. That's right. And it completely takes away the discretion, which is why police are against it, because they give a couple of examples. Let's say there's an 18-year-old who maybe they wouldn't want to have a concealed carry license. You know, they no longer have – they would have to give that – they would have to give that person that license. But it – you know, I think it's a debate. The big question is whether Republicans in the House or Senate will be able to override a veto that I think the governor will probably put down on this. And I don't think that they will.
And that's a big question not only for this proposal, Dan, but for another that the House passed earlier this year, which would do away with permitting as a wholesale essentially.
Right, right. I mean, we haven't really heard a lot about Second Amendment rights are a frequent issue in the state, especially when Republicans have large majorities as they do now. They haven't come up much. And what was interesting about the concealed carry bill, I believe it came out of committee with bipartisan support. And one of the Democrats on the committee, Senator Lasky, said, you know, she supports it. It does simply because it wouldn't seem to increase the prevalence of firearms or put them in the hands of someone who shouldn't. It would just simply, as Trent said, take away that subjectivity that that a single individual, your local police chief, would have. So it's hard to know how big a deal that politically this is going to be, but a veto would certainly set things in that direction.
That's certainly what I remember State Senate Majority Leader Jeb Bradley describing this repeatedly as a modest bill, that right. It would not make up much of a change. And so trying to characterize it in that way, maybe trying to build some more support for it.
That's right. And like Dan mentioned, I mean, it passed 5-0 out of Senate Judiciary with two Democrats voting for it. And then it was, I think it was 14-10, totally along party lines in the full Senate. So I don't know. I don't think that they would have the votes to override a veto.
Well, one issue that the Senate did not have enough votes yesterday to pass was gambling. And this was the idea of putting a casino bill out there is something that a couple of years ago might have been the first issue that we talked about at the start of the weekly news roundup because it was such a high profile issue. This year, it didn't even make it out of the chamber, which usually gave it the most support, the Senate.
Yeah, man, gambling is dead in New Hampshire, isn't it? It's a here's what I always find incredible about this is you have a Senate president, a Republican Senate president who lives in a town that probably would get a casino. And you have a Democrat who's incredibly well known and well connected in the state. And the two of them are on the same team trying to get gambling passed and just not able to do it. And I think the answer is the reason that that's happening is that the House just doesn't support it. I mean, we've seen the House essentially turn it down every single time. And so even, you know, I should add, the governor is also supportive of this. So I think what it really shows is how powerful our process is, right? How powerful the House can be in this entire discussion.
And all that's happened through a variety of external circumstances. So Massachusetts passes casinos. There's a fluster of activity in New Hampshire to either try and get ours up before they do or not. still doesn't happen. We're in a fiscal crisis. We're coming out of the recession. The argument is that we need casino revenue to help balance the budget. No casinos. We're in more flusher financial times, or at least more stable financial times, and there's less franticness around it, and perhaps the opportunity for a more measured long-term debate. Still no casinos. And I think with the Rockingham Park being put up for sale is sort of the indication that the largest player in the private sector in this debate is basically reading the writing on the wall, which frankly I think has been on the wall for some years now.
There was a piece in the Eagle Tribune when they were talking to Ed Callahan, who had been such a prominent player
General
in the gambling
manager,
debate
yeah.
in years past, and essentially sounded like he was washing his hands of the whole debate. He said, you know, we're just not really following it this year. We're moving on. And if a prominent voice like that is moving on, then what does that say about the whole rest of the process?
That it's over. There's going to be a casino 20 minutes away from Salem and in Massachusetts. And so there's no way to compete. And people are saying we shouldn't even try.
And as you mentioned, Dan, Rockingham Park, which had long been a proposed site for casinos, moving forward with its other plans, trying to put the, I think, 120 remaining acres out. Some others are already being developed. I'm curious to see going forward, and I don't know the answer to this, but members of the House have all along been pushing for Keno. And the Senate has always pushed back against that because it said, well, we don't want to have Keno sort of get in the way of a casino.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see what they make of Keno going forward.
Yeah, it's hard to know. I mean, you're right. It hasn't ever really been put to the test. And those members of the Senate who've been the most supportive of casino gambling, Democrat Lute Alessandro and Republican Chuck Morse, haven't really weighed in. I mean, it feels almost that would seem a real sort of anticlimax for the debate, just given, you know, the revenue potential and just sort of the marketing of, you know, the ability to for the state to market itself as a destination casino, you know, upscale casinos versus some Keno machines. But I think the debate will certainly be less divisive and less certainly quieter.
This is The Exchange. It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup, where you can join us with your comments and questions about what's been happening in New Hampshire news this week. The phone number, 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org, or send us your comments and questions by Facebook or Twitter. A lot of news and a lot of discussion this week about Governor Maggie Hassan's announcement that she had chosen a person to fill the so-called drug czar position. And joining us now on that and a number of other issues is NHPR's digital journalist, Brian Walston. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Brady.
We've talked a bit on this show about the proposals to address opioid abuse that have been making their way through the legislature. But now we have a person who's set to fill this drug czar position. From the Attorney General's office. Tell us about James Vera.
Right. We have not only a new person, but a new title. It's now the Governor's Advisor on Addiction and Behavioral Health.
Which I'm sure will supplant drug czar in the popular imagination immediately.
His name's James Vara. He's a Senior Assistant Attorney General. He is leading, I believe, still the Drug Prosecution Unit at the AG's office. He was also on state's drug task force, and he's co-chair of the opioid task force. I think he's been instrumental in developing the new rules on prosecuting possession and distribution of fentanyl, which putting him on the par with heroin. I think it's hard to separate this appointment from the criticism of the previous drug czar,
Jack Wozniak.
He's referenced as an administrator at Grafton County, but he did have background in treatment, and I believe that his emphasis on that, especially in the state's biggest city, Manchester, caused some friction. Both the police chief there, Nick Willard, and Mayor Ted Gatzis were critical of him at some point. But he was, you know, he did have a background at Beech Hill Hospital in Dublin, and a lot of his emphasis on his was on the treatment. And I think that some of the, going back the other way towards law enforcement, I believe, was aimed at blunting some of the criticism that dogged Jack Wozniak during his less than a year tenure.
So, Dan, coming back to something you said, where New Hampshire is still trying to figure out which tracks to navigate its way through this crisis, perhaps we can then read into the fact that the governor chose a prosecutor to head up this state effort to try and stop the opioid abuse.
Yeah, and I don't want to, like, you know, label Mr. Vera as one way or the other. I mean, he hasn't even been in the job yet, but I do think Brian's right. I mean, one of the biggest critiques of Jack Wozniak was a failure to really reach out to law enforcement and engage them in the car. And that led to not only the kind of pushback that Brian mentioned from the police chief in Manchester and the mayor, but also trickled into political opposition where you had Republicans on the executive council and then the legislature really saying that this guy's not really doing his job. He's a known quantity to a lot of these folks. He's been involved in this conversation. He sits on numerous panels that are looking at it. And I assume he will be studying very carefully Mr. Wozniak's example. But he certainly does, you know, his prosecutorial background and his public positions on various policies, he does have a strong belief in sort of the role for law enforcement in trying to solve this problem.
I think it's important, I mean, to point out that some of the people in the treatment community have praised this decision. I mean, the folks at New Futures, Tim Roark, who's chairman of the Governor's Commission, says that, you know, he knows these issues. He knows all the players. He certainly, as Dan mentioned, been involved in this realm for a long time. So, I have not read a lot of substantive criticism of the position other than, you know, perhaps we're going too far in away from the need for treatment and recovery services and more towards the law enforcement aspect.
I think there's no – if you talk to people on both sides of the aisle about James Vera, they will say that he is qualified, competent prosecutor. He's a qualified, competent prosecutor. People said the same thing about Jack Wozniak, right? He's a qualified, competent administrator. And the big question for both of these people will be – or the big question for Vera will be, can he handle the politics? I think what happened with Wozniak was the optics, the politics of this job, right? The governor's office set it up as the drug czar. And so there was this image that he would be in charge of the response, that he would be out there reaching out to all the police chiefs and he'd be, you know, donning a bulletproof vest and going out with them at night to see what it was like on the streets. But you know what? That's not what his job was. And as soon as people started coming out in opposition or questioning what he was doing, there wasn't a great political response. There wasn't the message never got out that, hey, we shouldn't have called him the drug czar. You know, he's advising us on some policies that we can be doing better. But that didn't sound quite as good. And then as soon as it became political, there was just no way for him to survive in that job. And so I think it's interesting that the governor's office not only changed the title of the job, right? They're really trying to get away from drug czar. They don't want us to be saying drug czar, drug czar, drug czar. And they also moved him to HHS. So they're really trying to make it clear that he is an advisor to the governor and that the governor is really trying to lead this response. And so the question is going to be, will this become political again? And if it does, will Vera be able to handle the politics of the job?
Brian, this position doesn't require confirmation from the executive council because it's under the governor's purview, but some of the funding does, if I understand correctly.
Right. It's going to come – I believe it's coming from the governor's – well, I think it's coming out of the governor's commission on alcohol and drug abuse prevention now. And they just approved I think there was a vote on a bill this week for $500,000 in additional funding for that body. I don't think that process is through yet, but they've been nibbling away at some of the funding that's been needed on that particular bill. But, one other thing about, you know, there's been such a push in the last year on the treatment and services area. And, you know, to the extent that Wozniak can claim has any claim for success in his position, I think you would – perhaps some people would point at that. I mean, one thing that's left to play out here, he was heavily criticized by the New Hampshire Medical Society for some of his prescribing guidelines that he wanted to see pushed through. And that's still moving through the process. I believe there's guidelines for the nurses and the physicians are supposed to be due in September. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out, but that could be one legacy of his position.
And just speaking of Jack Wozniak, the former so-called drug czar, he has a new job. He signed a one-year contract to manage the Dillon Hopkins Airport in Keene. So something to keep an eye on there. I'm sure he has a less controversial job title in that role. Now, Brian, you also cover campaign finance issues, and given that we have a very high-profile race for U.S. Senate in this state, it's probably no surprise that there is, or it appears to be, a lot of money starting to make its way into the campaign. Can you give us an idea of how much is a lot, or how much is maybe making its way in?
Well, I think compared to other races in other states, I mean, perhaps because New Hampshire is a relatively small state, but it's a very important state, especially in who's going to control that body. But, you know, Kelly Ayotte, Senator, the incumbent, has came into 2015 with $3 million on hand. She raised another $2 million just in the last quarter. Now, that's the only time that she's going head-to-head with Governor Hassan is that one quarter,
just that one
the fourth quarter.
Quarter.
And they both raised about the same amount of money. That said, I mean, Kelly Ayotte has right now enjoys a rather large cash-on-hand advantage over Senator Ayotte or Governor Hassan. But, you know, I mean, a lot of the conversation so far on this has been on the outside spending. There's been talk of a pledge. First, Senator Ayotte proposed a rather traditional pledge where they disavow or discourage outside spending. Governor Hassan sort of upped the ante a little bit by saying, well, let's cap the spending that campaigns could have. And that's where they're stuck. I mean, I don't think anything's been mentioned in this in the last couple of weeks. And in the meantime, the spending on by outside groups has reached you know, close to $4 million now, and it's about equal on both sides. What was interesting yesterday, the Washington Post had a story about how a lot of groups on the right who may be expected to get involved in the presidential race are starting to sort of gather their forces for trying to protect the majorities in the House and the Senate, and they're expected to spend heavily on those races. Now, you know, how that plays into a pledge scenario here, I mean, it would be, you know, there are already a lot of outside groups jumping in on the Republican side in the Senate race here. I you know, it would be interesting to know how that goes, whether those groups are going to be, you know, basically forced out or pushed out of that race here. That would certainly benefit Governor Hassan for sure.
So a lot of factors essentially from external factors essentially, Trent, that could determine the amount of money that winds up coming into this state for that Senate race in the fall.
Sure. And I'm going to do some quick math just to sort of explain how big these external factors will be. This race is probably going to be an $80 million race. So if you thought that the presidential primary was a big deal here in New Hampshire, just wait till you see what happens with this Senate race. This is going to be one of the most expensive Senate races in the country and will break all records here in New Hampshire. So you have an $80 million Senate race. You probably have $15 or $20 million from Ayotte and Hassan, right, from their actual campaigns. So that gets you about almost halfway there. The remainder of that money is coming from outside groups that they are not going to be in control of. So I think what we're going to see is just complete bloodbath here. I think that outside groups, if you talk to people in D.C., they say this is one of three races in the country where they really like the odds. Both sides really like the odds of winning. And so they are willing to invest. And I think we'll see probably between $40 and $45 million in outside money coming into, you know, so that means like nonstop TV advertising, radio, all kinds of stuff, digital ads.
Lots to look forward to, in other words, then.
For us.
That's Trent Spinner of the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. NHPR's Dan Berk is with us. And NHPR's Brian Walston, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you, Brady.
We'll have more after a short break. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange here on New Hampshire Public Radio. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Brady Carlson. Today on The Exchange, it's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. And we hope you'll join us with your comments and questions about the latest stories happening here in the Granite State at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. With us for the hour is NHPR Senior Policy and Politics Editor Dan Berk and Trent Spinner, Executive Editor of the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. Just before the break, we were talking about the U.S. Senate race between incumbent Republican Kelly Ayotte and Democratic Governor Maggie Hassan, which Trent referred to cheerfully as a bloodbath, perhaps, at least in terms of the amount of money and perhaps ads coming in. One issue that certainly Democrats have been trying to wield against Republicans in New Hampshire, among other states, is the issue of President Obama's nominee to the U.S. Supreme Court, Merrick Garland. Senator Ayotte addressed that on Thursday. Here's some of what she said.
Obviously, with the Supreme Court, these fights become very political. And I think that when you have this type of balance heading into a presidential election, that's why I've said, let's have the people of the country weigh in. I think that will actually make this less of a political process in the middle of the election season.
So that's Senator Kelly Ayotte speaking Thursday about the potential or not potential for a confirmation hearing and a vote in the U.S. Senate on President Obama's nominee to the Supreme Court. So, Dan, this is something that obviously has been playing out since Justice Scalia died and clearly isn't going away, at least not yet.
It's clearly not going away, but it also doesn't really seem to be evolving any. I mean, Senate Republicans seem fairly well dug in on their position that Senator Ayotte just articulated, that they will not be meeting with, debating, or voting on Justice Garland's nomination for those reasons, that the next president should get a chance to do this. The only, if you want to call it any movement from Ayotte has been that she said she'd be willing to meet with him, but simply to say thanks.
Here's why this isn't going anywhere.
Which I guess is a step in the right direction. If you're someone who feels that there should be at least some acknowledgement of that of his nomination, but I think it's hard. This unified Republican position does put someone like Ayotte, who's up for re-election in a tough race in a swing state, in potentially a tough spot. And I don't know whether or not folks like her, other sort of more swing state senators who are up for re-election, will be either breaking off from this if it continues to be seen as political baggage. Democrats certainly think it is. It's hard to know how it's actually playing within, the race hasn't really engaged yet in any meaningful way. It's hard to know whether this will, what this means for Justice Garland's future, but also just for this basic constitutional question that's underlying here, which is what, does the president's nomination to the Supreme Court have the right under the Constitution to get a timely hearing?
I think in New Hampshire, when we talk about politics, we talk about independence and where they're going. And I think one thing we need to look at is sort of where what those people think about this decision. And so here's where Kelly Ayotte gets put in a very difficult position by what Republicans at the Senate level are trying to do. CNN has a poll out this morning, and they say that 55% of Republicans say that there should be hearings. 67% of Democrats say there should be hearings. That's not really a surprise, right? Democrats would, of course, support this decision. Here's what's really interesting if you dig down into the numbers. 68% of independents, 68%. So more than the independents, more than Democrats think that there should be a hearing. And I think that's going to become a very challenging issue for the Ayotte campaign, because I think that they are really going to be dependent on independents voting for them over Maggie Hassan. And when you have more independents saying, let's do this hearing, than Democrats, I think you can see that it's going to become a very important issue in this race.
One last note before we move on. On Thursday, NHPR's Josh Rogers tweeted out, he was at an event, and he tweeted out a photo of Senator Ayotte and Governor Hassan sitting next to each other at this event. And I have to say, I've covered a number of events where they seem to always seat those two together. And it can't escape the people who plan these events that here you have two people who are looking at running at each other against each other in the fall. And they can't resist the idea, I suppose, of putting them together and having reporters like us putting those photos together of the two potential candidates.
Right. It's a funny thing. We talk about candidates facing off or running against each other, but the opportunities for them to actually engage one-on-one are actually quite limited. I mean, oftentimes it may just be the moments during the commercial breaks during a televised debate when they may want to wander from their podium for a couple minutes. But Senator Ayotte and Governor Hassan actually have, they have a history. Governor Hassan was a state senator when Ayotte was attorney general. They're known, they've sort of been circling each other in politics and statehouse issues for a while. And like I said, I mean, folks like us are paying attention to this race in March, 7 months, 8 months before the election. But I feel the real dynamic of the tenor of it and the issues that are going to dominate it has really yet to be decided, you know, whether or not the Supreme Court nomination issue is going to remain or something, some other piece of news will rise to the top that will really define the tone and the substance of this race. I still really don't know.
Let's take a look at some of the other issues that have been in the news this week. The state has been investigating chemical contamination of wells in Merrimack and Litchfield. The reporter who's been covering that here at NHPR is Emily Corwin, who joins us now with more. Hi, Emily.
Hi, Brady.
Remind us of the concern here about this particular chemical and ending up in the water.
Sure. So listeners might remember not very long ago, a lot of reporting we did here and others have done around the state on a chemical called PFOS, PFOS, out in Portsmouth at the former Pease Air Force Base. It's almost the exact same contaminant they're finding in Merrimack around the St. Gobain plastics plant. Slightly different, but, you know, for all intents and purposes, like, it's the same. And there are health outcomes that are not proven causation, but are pretty well established by the scientific researchers, by the scientific communities. And, you know, those really run the gamut from, possible effects on kidney, on, I think, liver, immune effects, all the way to, you know, certain cancers. And it's not like if you consume this stuff, you will get those things, because we all consume them at a certain degree in our water. There's a base level. But in high amounts, it's pretty well established that there are negative health outcomes.
And the high, and in this case, the levels detected in the water in Merrimack and Litchfield was several times, if I remember right, higher than the state standard.
Oh, sure. Certainly higher than the baseline. And it ranges a great deal. So they're testing a mile radius of this plant. And two locations have shown up with, like, you know, really high levels. You know, it's all relative, but, you know, higher than others. And sort of then, other than those two, it sort of decreases gradually to a baseline in that area. So, you know, not everybody is hitting the state's threshold for, you know, receiving bottled water, for getting the state to pay for your blood tests. Actually, only two families are drinking from wells that are high enough to qualify for those things. But the science is out there that, you know, even at the baseline level that we're drinking this stuff, everyone, you know, even that could be affecting our health. And so it's the state and the feds are in a really awkward position, I think, of trying to figure out what a threshold should be for considering something toxic, when the science is A, inconclusive, but B, sort of well known to be bad no matter how much of this stuff you're drinking.
And part of the challenge for regulators in the state is that there is no threshold. There's no specific number where they need to act. And what they're looking at is about 400 parts per trillion. So in every little drop of water, if you broke it down into a trillion different pieces, 400 of those would be PFOA. That's the number that they start to get concerned. But they've said we need federal regulators to kind of step in here and set a number. The other challenge for them is that each one of these tests costs $385, and it takes a long time to do. So
the blood tests.
Yes. And so, you know, that's a real challenge in a small state.
Let's hear now from one of our listeners. Latasha is calling from Merrimack. Hi, Latasha. You're on the exchange.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I'm so glad you're bringing this up. And I just wanted to say I was at the town meeting, and I became very frustrated. One very important fact about PFOA that is not that was actually dismissed when I brought it up in my comments and questions to the panel, and I feel that it's not being addressed by the media either, is the fact that PFOA is bioaccumulative. It builds up in the kidneys, the liver, the serum, and the blood, and over time, no matter how much you're exposed to, it continues to build. It does not evacuate the system. The half-life, depending on your exposure, is between 2 to 9 years. That's half the time it takes for it to evacuate your body. And the 400 parts per trillion, that's a short-term exposure from weeks to months. Long-term exposure, a year or more, there was a study in a community in mid-Ohio. They were only exposed for a year to 50 parts per trillion and found had adverse health effects. I also brought that up to the panel, and again, it was really not addressed. But the accumulative nature of this chemical is really what's vastly important, because no matter how much our wells here, whether we're at 100 parts per trillion or at the 30 parts per trillion, if we've been drinking and it's the water and it's been in that water for a year or more, we have built up more than that in our system, and therefore having thyroid disease, kidney disease, several others. I think there's a colitis that's also on the list of six illnesses that were seen as probable links by a panel of epidemiologists.
And I'm just gonna break in here just for a moment, Latasha, because
I want to
make sure that I give our panel a chance to respond. Thank you so much for your comments. And Emily, you were also at that meeting in Merrimack. Probably heard what she had to say. Was that indicative of the kind of concerns that residents were bringing up?
Right. So there's this thing that happens at these panels. And, you know, it was the same in Portsmouth with Pease. And it basically, you know, when an epidemiologist, when you do population studies, they're looking for a kind of scientific outcome that just really doesn't happen when you're dealing with something as, you know, hard to show causation as, you know, as this sort of scenario. And so what happens, it's the same as with smoking. It took a really long time and it was really hard, especially with the lobbying that came from these smoking, you know, these tobacco companies, to prove causation, which is what the scientific community has historically used as, you know, the baseline for saying something's toxic. And in the meantime, short of that kind of, you know, gold standard proof, people like Benjamin Chan and others are in a position where they've been taught not to acknowledge, not to really hold as fact any sort of scientific results that show some conflict, right? And in the meantime, the scientific community, I think, is in agreement that there are definite concerns, that there are definite, you know, like the things that the caller is talking about, those are real. But it hasn't been proven to the degree that scientists like to see in order to really acknowledge it and own it. And I think that puts a lot of things are putting DHHS in a tough spot right now. That's one of them.
And Latasha, just so you know, and for our listeners, we are putting together a show with more on this issue of PFOA in Merrimack and Litchfield over the coming week. So we'll keep you posted on when that's coming. Emily, just briefly, another issue you've been following this week is commuter rail. The State House took out some proposed funding for rail planning from the governor's 10-year transportation plan. And after that, some advocates in Nashua decided to hold a public meeting. What happened there and what was their goal?
Right. So interestingly, it was the mayor of Nashua, Jim Donchus, who sort of hosted this. His staffers had printed up some sheets of paper that had sort of, you know, talking points, how to contact your senators. Senator from Nashua, Betty Lasky, did a lot of talking there. And the idea, there was a huge crowd. The idea was like, okay, people, you want rail. Here are the senators you need to call to get this back in this bill so that the, you know, the Senate can add back into the transportation bill this $4 million in federal funds. Then they can, you know, shoot it over to the House, and the House would vote again. And in that time, it was a very narrow margin that the House, you know, removed this from. In that time, you know, these advocates are saying we can call up these House members, convince them to keep it in the bill, have another vote, and like maybe this will actually, you know, stay in that 10-year transportation bill. It's $4 million in federal funds they're hoping for.
All right, that's NHPR's Emily Corwin giving us an update on the PFOA issue in Merrimack and Litchfield and the commuter rail issue in southern New Hampshire. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
This is the Exchange Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Just a couple of quick items from this week's news. We often talk about what goes on inside the State House, but it looks like the State House itself is now going to get some restoration work. The dome has not exactly been at its shiniest in recent years. And at the same time, Trent, the State House may now be open on at least Saturdays, if not all weekends, for the first time, I think, ever.
Right. Yeah. Yes. The greater Concord Chamber of Commerce is looking to make sure that there are tours, that people can come in on Saturdays, I think in the spring and fall. And I live in town. I think it would be a great opportunity. You know, they do this in Vermont, and they have an incredible website where you can learn all about the State House and you can figure out when the tours are. And it seems like it's a real tourist attraction, which I think Concord could use. And so I think, you know, I think it's a good idea. There are a couple of questions left about who pays for security and how the bathrooms are going to work. But, you know, it seems like an easy thing to do.
And finally, we wrap up with some economic news, Dan. There's a job opening in Lincoln, New Hampshire. Clark's Trading Post now needs a full-time wolfman. Anybody looking for a career change?
I don't know. Brady, you're probably one of the more versatile guys I know.
If nominated, I will not run. And if elected, I will not serve. Well, last question for you each. What will you be covering over the coming week? I'll start with you, Trent.
I think we have to see next week what happens in the Senate. I think it's going to be another busy week. And so we'll be paying attention.
Dan?
We talked a lot about the Senate race today, which will obviously be a high profile and very important race. But I'm actually really interested in the governor's race. I think we're seeing more candidates come forward. Senator Jeanne Forrester indicated she'll make an official announcement that she's going to be running next week. That brings to four, I believe, now the number of Republicans. There's at least two Democrats running.
It's the largest GOP field in over a decade.
Yeah, and a pretty interesting one. I mean, you know, it's hard to know. There's no obvious front runner there. You've got Executive Counselor Chris Sununu, Manchester Mayor Ted Gatzis, Representative Frank Edelblu, and Forrester. And I think with an open seat in a unpredictable political year, and a lot of big issues facing the state, I'm just interested in seeing how that starts to take shape. And with Forrester's announcement entry next week, give us a little bit more clarity on that race.
Well, a big thanks to both of you for wrapping up all of the week's news. Trent Spinner, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's Trent Spinner, executive editor for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. And Dan Barrick, thanks to you as well.
Thanks, Brady.
That's NHPR senior policy and politics editor, Dan Barrick. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Faith Meixel. We had help this week from Jessica Hunt. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Brady Carlson.